1900 UTC, and that means it's time for That's News to Me. I'm your host, DJ Marcus. Let's see what's happening in the world today. Yes, yes indeed. Welcome, welcome. It's December 11th. That's right, 12-11-2020. And it's time for News to Me. This is the Friday edition, which means that it's pre-recorded. So, good luck. I'm recording this at, 10 o'clock local time. So that's what time is at UTC. It is 16:48 UTC right now. So I'm talking to you from the past. Anyway, let's get going. I've still got news for you. Let's get moving. Come on, let's do it. Wrong button. My buttons are all funny. Curses. Oh, anyway, here it is. World news. Boom. First up from the BBC, China is asking cabin crew to wear nappies to reduce virus risk. That's right. You heard me right. China's aviation regulator has recommended cabin crew wear disposable nappies or diapers and avoid using the toilet to cut the risk of COVID-19 infection. The advice on nappies is in a section on personal protective equipment and new guidelines for airlines. The regulators said the recommendation applied to charter flights to high-risk COVID-19 destinations. Globally, airlines and airports have been making big changes to how they operate to get passengers flying again. The Civil Aviation Administration of China laid out its advice in a new 49-page set of guidelines for airlines to prevent the spread of the virus. The recommendations on nappies applies to charter flights to and from places where infections exceed 500 in every 1 million people. It comes on top of the advice for cabin crew to wear medical masks, disposable gloves, caps, goggles, disposable protective clothing, and shoe coverings. Flight crew are also advised to wear a range of protective gear, but not nappies. The global aviation industry has been struggling to rebound from the pandemic's debilitating impact on travel. So yeah, there you go. That smell is your stewardess now, or your flight attendant. Sticking with China, this comes to us from CNN, but it's not really a big surprise to anyone who's been following the news. Hong Kong media tycoon Jimmy Lai has been charged under the controversial national security law on Friday. Lai, who's 73, is known for his support for the city's democracy movement and criticizing mainland China. He was charged on suspicion of colluding with foreign forces and endangering national security. He is the most high-profile person to be charged under the law, which was imposed by Beijing in June. The offense of colluding with foreign powers carries a maximum penalty of life imprisonment. Lai was arrested in August on the same day that about 200 officers raided the newsroom of his pro-democracy tabloid. Oh, now they call it a tabloid. Which is kind of funny. Back whenever Apple Daily was publishing pro-democracy and the protests were going on, they were a local newspaper and they were doing good for the world. And now they're a pro-democracy tabloid. Speaking it to CNN at his home in Kowloon in August, Lai said his arrest was a symbolic exercise by local authorities. So we'll see how this plays out. Hopefully, he gets out of prison and doesn't die there. He's 73, so the sentence couldn't be that long either way, I guess. I sorted them by country today, so we got one more from China. Don't get grumpy about it. Chinese authorities have detained Bloomberg News Beijing staff member Hayes Fan. So Chinese authorities have detained, I guess it might be Haze Fan, who works for the Bloomberg News Bureau in Beijing on suspicion of endangering national security. Fan was last in contact with one of her editors around 11:30 a.m. local time on Monday. Shortly after, she was seen being escorted from her apartment building by plainclothes security officials. Throughout the 4 days since her disappearance, Bloomberg has sought information on Fan's whereabouts from the Chinese government and the Chinese embassy. Her family was informed within 24 hours. Bloomberg LP, the parent of Bloomberg News, on Thursday received confirmation that Fan is being held on suspicion of participating in activities endangering national security. We are very concerned for her and have been actively speaking to Chinese authorities to better understand the situation. Surprise, surprise, this story doesn't come to us from Bloomberg, which I think would be reporting this, but from Al Jazeera. Woo, man. We're just doing good on time. We're having a good time. I'm excited. By today, I was like, I'm going to only pick a few stories, and then that way I can not worry about it, like trying to rush through, and we'll just talk all the way through. And so far, I'm feeling good about it. We'll see.
Get the news over with. I want to hear the music.
Well, we got a song today too, don't worry. First up, our friends at the World Socialist website, that's WhiskeySierra.org. Indian farmers are threatening to expand their protests after the Bharatiya Janata Party, led central government, reiterated that it will not repeal the three pro-agribusiness laws it rushed through Parliament last September. Hundreds of thousands of farmers, many with their wives and children, are currently camped at four entrances to the Delhi National Capital Territory. Many have been there since November 27, when phalanxes of security forces acting on the orders of Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his BJP government barred them from bringing their Delhi Chalo, Let's Go to Delhi, agitation to India's capital and largest city. On Tuesday, millions across India joined a Bharat Bandh, All India Shutdown, called by farmer organizations, according to the coordination committee of the Kisan Morcha Peasants March. More than 5 million people participated in the four-hour shutdown, with 20,000 protests held in at least 22 of India's 28 states. In the Punjab, where the farmers' agitation is centered, daily life ground to a halt. In Haryana, which lies between Punjab and Delhi, there were protests throughout the state. Markets were shut down, and several roads and highways were occupied. Workers from Maruti Suzuki, Hero Motorcycle, and other plants in the Gurgaon Manesar Industrial Belt, which lies in Haryana on the outskirts of Delhi, held a demonstration in support of the farmers. On Tuesday evening, Modi's chief henchman, Home Minister Amit Shah, led a government delegation in a hastily organized four-hour meeting with representatives of some of the dozens of farm organizations that are leading the protest movement. Shah repeated previous government offers to make minor amendments to the three laws, which will throw open Indian agriculture to domestic and transnational corporations by gutting the system of state-run markets and reducing or eliminating restrictions on contract farming and land ownership. But he dismissed out of hand the farmers' call for the three laws to be repealed. Big business, which applauded the agrarian reform laws and an accompanying labor reform that outlaws most strikes and promotes labor market flexibility, is adamant that the BJP government stand its ground. Of course! The large multinational corporations really want the government to not give workers or not restore worker rights. Oh man, come on. First, because they view modernizing Indian agriculture at small farmers' expense a key element in competing with China for investment, and second, because they fear a visible government retreat in the face of the farmers' protests would galvanize social opposition. So the story goes on for quite a ways if you want to read more about it, but it's very clear that money and greed are driving these kind of changes when India isn't quite ready to open up for international trade like that. So, stand with those guys for sure. And The Guardian has a. So, that most recent story was from the World Socialist website. The Guardian's also covering this. But they are saying that the determination of protesters has put India's ruling party in a tight spot. Clearly not expecting a nationwide strike during the pandemic, the world's strictest lockdown, and the public fear of contagion have been readily leveraged to limit democratic expression of dissent. With various restrictions in place, the Modi government has viewed the pandemic as a rare opportunity to muscle through a number of tough market reforms. The guiding principle has been that the crisis is a time for bold decisions and bold investment to prepare a globally competitive domestic supply chain. So the rationale is that the pandemic offers a moment in which global investment could potentially be diverted from China to India. The contagion was not just a public health disaster, but also a reminder that China, as the factory of the world, dominates global manufacturing and thereby critical supply chains. As the backlash against China has grown, so has the possibility of rechanneling manufacturing to other nations. So, yeah, this is kind of boils it all down for you, huh? It's like, yes, we would love to make millions of dollars off the lives of our workers. How can we do that? Oh, that was a bad idea. So, I had a little bit of Dahong Pao left, and I had a little bit of Jinjin Mei left, and so I made small cups of tea of both teas, and then I was like, well, I need to make tea today. So I combined the two leftover teas from yesterday and made a tea with it today, and it is tea, but it has lost the goodness of both teas, does not combine to make a good tea. So anyway, that's my mess up. Anyway, we're about 11 minutes or so into the show, and I want to be sure and remind you that the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe comes up at 19:30 UTC every single day. So not just Friday, not Monday through Friday like this show. No, Monday through Monday, you can tune in. You don't know what day it is. It's fine. Just look at the clock, and when it's 19:30 UTC, connect to Anon Radio, and you will hear Tobe. You'll learn what he's doing, and based on that, you can figure out what time of day it is. Anyway, I don't know if you can help with day of the week. If you tune in early before at 1900 and you hear me, all right, then it's Monday through Friday. But if you don't hear me, it's probably the weekend. Anyway, I'm just being dumb. I've got a song for you today. What?
Get the news over with. I want to hear the
music.
That's
right. This is The Immigrant Song by Led Zeppelin.
Listening to Anon Radio, powered by SDF Public Access Unix System.
That's right. You're listening to Anon Radio. This is powered by SDF, and I'm DJ Marcus. This is news to me. We're going through news around the world and around the country, in the U.S., that is. I'm just kind of keeping up to date with what's going on out there. It's Friday, December 11th, and we are coming up at 19:15 UTC. So we've got about 15 minutes to go, and about 8 or 9 stories, so I think we're right on track. Okay, we've still got a few international, or
world news,
world stories to go through. First up, in positive news, I guess, conservation officials in Scotland have said the coastal sand dunes at Donald Trump's Aberdeenshire Golf Resort have lost their special status as a protected environmental site. Nature Scott, Scotland's nature agency, said the following construction of the Trump International Golf Course links course at Mean
North of Aberdeen, the dunes no longer merit being retained as part of the site of specific scientific merit being retained as part of the site of the site of special scientific interest. The sand dunes had been a high-quality example of a geological system characteristic of northeast Scotland, but it said that despite nature conservation work by the Trump Golf Course to protect the rare habitat and plants remaining on the site, there is now no longer a reason to protect the dunes at Mean, as they do not include enough of the special natural features for which they were designated. Bob Ward, the Policy and Communications Director at the London School of Economics Climate Change Research Institute, said, "This is a bitterly disappointing decision, which shows that golf still trumps the environment when it comes to Scotland's natural heritage. This part of the Aberdeenshire coast had a magnificent sand dune system that was of great geological interest and was protected site of special scientific interest." Ward, who'd been closely following the environmental impact of the Trump course, said the news opened the door to further harm to the remaining dunes from the construction of a second Trump golf course at the site. Scottish authorities have approved plans for a second Trump golf course next to the original one, which opened in 2012. Of course, this is just another example of how capitalism's terrible for the world, and if you got the money, honey, then countries have the time, and these institutions that we give power to maintain and protect our environment, you know, if they have to get money to do other things, guess what? You don't fucking matter anymore. So, anyway, fuck Trump. I hope he chokes and dies and all of his properties burn to the ground. Speaking of things burning to the ground, this is from the New York Post, but it was reported in a few other spots. Let me see if I can't find a better. I just grabbed it from the headlines I was looking at, but let's see if there's a better source, because there are sometimes question marks for that one. Here we go, independent.co.uk. Taipei earthquake, 6.7 magnitude tremor hits Taiwan capital. An earthquake of magnitude 6.7 struck near Taipei, the capital of Taiwan, on Thursday afternoon. There are no immediate reports of damage, but Taipei-based The Independent... Oh, The Independent employs over 100 journalists around the world. And this apparently happened near their office. Contributor William Yang said it felt like a huge earthquake. The epicenter of the quake was located 26 kilometers from the east coast of Yilan County, and it was felt in northern parts of Taiwan, according to the country's Central Weather Bureau. Buildings shook briefly in the capital of Taipei, but there have been no reports of injuries or significant damage. So that's cool. Way to go, Taipei. Way to go, Taiwan. Great country. Or great buildings, anyway. Oh, man. Now, are you ready for this? This is pretty exciting, or sad news, depending on who you are. Remember we talked about Pornhub and credit card payments? Well, there's an update. MasterCard has severed ties with Pornhub, and Visa has suspended payment processing after the adult website was accused of hosting videos of child abuse and rape. The payment companies took action after their own investigations into allegations made by the New York Times and reviews of their relationship with the Canadian-based website. Our investigation over the past several days has confirmed violations of our standards prohibiting unlawful content on their site. As a result, in accordance with our policies, we instructed the financial institutions that connect the site to our network to terminate acceptance. Visa has said its own investigation is ongoing, but it's suspended use by Pornhub for the time being. The website's denied there is any illegal material on it and stated that it employs moderators to screen all uploads. But because of the controversy, it announced that it would block all unverified users from uploading content. The company called the moves by the card company as exceptionally disappointing, as they come just 2 days after Pornhub instituted the most far-reaching safeguards. This news is crushing for the hundreds of thousands of models who rely on our platform for their livelihood. Pornhub says it gets 100 million visits a day and more than 36 billion a year. So yeah, so good luck there. Hopefully, you know, maybe they'll start accepting cryptocurrency or something. But if you have an e-commerce site and the payment vendor or your payment processor says, no, we don't want to do business with you anymore, you are good luck. That's going to be, you're facing a really uphill battle if your revenue goes from millions of dollars a day to zero. All right, so let's go into some more sad U.S. news now. U.S. vaccine near, but deaths rising by 9/11 proportions each day. A mounting U.S. death toll has tempered enthusiasm about a coming COVID-19 vaccine, with 9/11-like fatalities projected every day for the months ahead, even with a rapid rollout of inoculations. Another 2,902 U.S. deaths were reported on Thursday, a day after a record 3,253 people died, a pace projected to continue for the next 2 to 3 months until the vaccine can be widely distributed. Those daily tolls are roughly equivalent to the 2,996 killed on the attacks on September 11th, and greater than the 2,403 killed in the 1941 attacks on Pearl Harbor. Probably for the next 60 to 90 days, we're going to have more deaths per day than we had on 9/11 or Pearl Harbor, Dr. Robert Redfield, director of the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, told the Council on Foreign Relations Thursday. The reality is, the vaccine approval this week is not going to really impact that, I think, to any degree for the next 60 days. Moving with unprecedented, the rest is kind of propaganda for the process. But yeah, deaths are projected to reach 502,000 by April 1st, according to an influential model. The Institute revised the number down by about 37,000 on Thursday with the release of more detailed information about the vaccine. By comparison, heart disease killed 655,381 people in the U.S. and cancer 599,274 in 2018. So, yeah, it's a serious business. It's a lot scary, pretty much. But that's not the only thing happening. In Chicago, the United Airlines is... company, United Airlines is a major airline here, is telling some flight attendants whose colleagues test positive for COVID-19 to keep flying and monitor for symptoms. Oh yeah, you gotta love it. Workers need more rights, and these businesses need to be held accountable when they do this kind of shit. Oh my god. To keep flying and monitor for symptoms, three employees told Reuters, raising concerns among staff about the policy. Most of us feel that's unsafe, said one of the employees. Reuters also viewed around a dozen comments in a private online group for United flight attendants, which expressed unease and frustration about loose quarantine and contact tracing protocols by the airline. United's major rival, American Airlines, removes all crew from service when they have worked with an infected person, a policy decision American flight attendants and the union representing them affirmed. The Federal Aviation Administration has issued COVID-19 policy recommendations, but there are no government mandates. So it's very scary times indeed. If you're flying, if your airline does care about you and make you wear PPE, you got to wear a diaper because you can't use the toilets on the plane. But if they don't care about you, like United Airlines, then I mean, you don't even get to take off work if you're exposed to the virus. So yeah. That's kind of a nice little contrast. But yeah, in general, if you're going out in the U.S. to buy anything at any of the stores, just kind of assume that no matter what, the people that work there, even if they're exposed, they had to go to work, because that seems to be the common thing, is that it's just expected. Even if you're actively sick, if you're not going to the emergency room, people are just, employers are just forcing their employees to work, or just letting them be fired. But, okay, so enough of that kind of death. Let's talk about another unjust death that happened in the U.S. This is coming to us from The Guardian today. Abolish the death penalty. Brandon Bernard execution prompts wave of anger. A wave of outrage from human rights groups, activists, elected officials, and others over the execution Thursday night of federal prisoner Brandon Bernard continued to grow on Friday behind a coordinated call for the abolition of the death penalty. Bernard, 40, was executed by lethal injection at a federal prison in Terre Haute, Indiana, after the U.S. Supreme Court rejected a last-minute appeal to stay the execution, and Donald Trump did not publicly respond to calls for him to intervene. After 17 years without a federal execution, the Trump administration has executed 9 inmates since July and plans 5 more executions before Joe Biden takes office on January 20th. Biden's pledge to eliminate the death penalty. Massachusetts Representative Ayanna Pressley, the sponsor of legislation in the House to end the federal death penalty, tweeted footage on Thursday night of Bernard speaking from prison. "Abolish the death penalty," she wrote. That call was taken up by activists from Pressley's progressive allies in Congress to Vinita Gupta, president of the Leadership Council on Civil and Human Rights. And so, Just the backstory. Bernard was sentenced for a role in the 1999 killings in Texas of an Iowa couple whose bodies he burned in the trunk of their car after they were shot by an accomplice. He directed his last words to the family. I'm sorry, he said. That's the only words that I can say that completely capture how I feel and feel now and how I felt that day. He was pronounced dead at 9:27 Eastern Time. He was 19 when he committed the murder, tweeted Julian Castro, the former housing secretary from Texas. Since then, five jurors and a former prosecutor have said they don't support the death penalty in his case. Brandon will be the ninth person executed. And really, if you followed this case at all, this person had kind of, he'd done... If you leave... it's death penalty is very interesting because it's one of those things that's like... It's a retribution, but who's it for? It's not a deterrent against crime. It's usually just for, like, the families. But if the person is sentenced to death and then is going to be on death row for 40 years, in 40 years, or 20 years, 30 years, it's like they're a totally different person. And it's just, anyway, I think that the death penalty should be abolished. I think it's an immoral position for a state to take. Anyway, yeah, it's just really sad. He was he had totally been reformed, and it was a really sad kind of thing. Anyway, you can check out more about that if you want. His name was Brandon Bernard. All right, and a crisis of invisibility inside San Francisco's planned Native American Cultural Center. The Bay Area is among the most racially and ethnically diverse regions in the U.S., but it's only slowly grappling with its self-understanding as a home for significant populations of Native Americans. An ambitious project is hoping to help address a challenge that the region's Native populations have grappled with since the occupation of Alcatraz Island in the 1960s and 70s. Crisis of Invisibility. The Village, a multi-year project with funding from the philanthropic investor Cat Taylor, is intended to become a center of Native culture and heritage. The effort's an outgrowth of the Mission District's 57-year-old Friendship House, which describes itself as the longest-running social service organization in the U.S., run by and for American Indians. Which I think it's Indigenous people or Native Americans. I think Indigenous people is more accepted now. But anyway, San Francisco and the population in general needs to know that Native people are still here. Said filmmaker and advocate Peter Bratt, who lived briefly on Alcatraz as a child and who served on Friendship House's board for more than 20 years. What comes with being invisible is you also become a community that's underserved. So we'll see how that goes. It's very interesting stuff. And more standing up to the man. Red House blockade in Portland, a combustible situation that requires intense negotiation. This is coming to us from the Oregonian. Mayor Ted Wheeler has authorized Portland police to use all lawful means to clear protesters from the site of the Red House on North Mississippi Avenue and the nearly three block long occupation zone encompassing it. But figuring out how to clear dozens of people who have fortified the streets with makeshift barriers and piles of homemade weapons is a logistical and safety nightmare. Activists since Tuesday have stacked wooden boards, corrugated metal sheets, nail-studded spike strips, tires, fences, and accumulated an arsenal ranging from glass bottles to rocks in the tightly packed residential neighborhood in support of a black indigenous family who lost their house in a foreclosure. That's why a peaceful resolution demands intense negotiations between the city, the new owner of the house, and the family with help from any community leaders who might hold sway, the expert said. All the parties also must recognize that allowing the occupation to continue isn't safe for activists, residents, and businesses nearby. It's a combustible mixture, said Chuck Wexler, executive director of the Police Executive Research Forum, an independent Washington, D.C.-based organization that does research on policing. It's a no-win situation for the police, but police don't have the luxury of walking away. So anyway, that's all the time we got today. I'll see you next week on Monday.
Well, 14. That sound means that our time's come to an end. Thanks for listening. I'll be back tomorrow and every weekday, Monday through Friday, before the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe at 1900 UTC. Talk to you then.
Shout out to everybody and come party. Talk to you later. Jazzmas, Ratsu, X1, Exile.